Do you ever wonder what therapists talk about over coffee? Well, we're three clinical psychologists, Dr. Diana Hill, Dr. Ray Littlewood, and Dr. Debbie Sorensen, and we'd like to welcome you to Psychologists Off the Clock. In this podcast, you'll get a glimpse into the books we read, the research we think is interesting, and the ideas from psychology that we use to thrive in our own lives. Our webpage is www.offtheclockpsych.com, and there you can find resources we mention in this episode, as well as other podcasts we've posted. You can also find us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. Thanks for listening. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Debbie. It's so good to see you.
Good to see you, too. It's been a while since we recorded a podcast together because we had a few guests in a row, so happy to be here.
Yeah, and it was fun to see you in person a little bit ago when you came to Santa Barbara. We had sort of a reunion of psychologists here, and it was fun to take an ocean dive with you in a yoga class and have some real in-person time together.
Yeah, it was really nice to see you too. It was a quick trip, but very memorable, especially that cold ocean plunge.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to talk to you about today's topic. Today, Diana and I are going to be talking about technology and the role that technology plays in our lives, which seems to be more and more a bigger and bigger role over time. And so definitely a hot topic.
Mm-hmm. It's really hard to believe that the iPhone was introduced only about 10 years ago in 2007. And how much has changed in our lives since then. And I was thinking about it, that our phones pretty much run our lives. So everything from our alarm clocks to our workouts to tracking our fertility to, I mean, I was thinking about my mom's phone number. I don't even know her cell phone number if I needed to call her in an emergency because it's in my phone. Mm-hmm. And they store our most intimate details about ourselves and communicate to our most important people. And we've gotten really attached. So we've also noticed starting to emerge in clinical practice and working with our own kids. And then also in terms of the research, there's some problems associated with this increase in use in technology. In 2015, the Pew Research Center reported that 72% of U.S. adults own smartphones, and there may be some issues with overuse in terms of undermining our well-being. So today we're going to talk about some specific areas. We're going to start by talking about how they're can be addictive, and then we're going to talk a little bit about how smartphone use and technology may be impacting our sleep, our attention span, relationships, and our physical health. And then we're going to hopefully explore some strategies that we could use so that we could engage with our technology in a little bit more of a sustainable way.
That sounds good. It's hard to even imagine life without an iPhone now. It's amazing that it's been 10 years because it's just so pervasive in our lives. And I think that, you know, for the purpose of today, for this podcast, we're really going to focus on some of the downsides of technology and how it's affecting people. But we want to also just acknowledge that, you know, the smartphones and internet and technology can be useful too. I mean, it helps us stay in touch with people. It helps us stay informed about current events. It can really add to efficiency and convenience. So, you know, it's not inherently bad. But what I think, something that we've really noticed that I think will come up a lot today, is that it can get so easily out of balance for people that it can just take over. And technology is changing so rapidly that we don't really have a great understanding of the long-term impact of all this technology use. And I think that, you know, people are getting more and more interested in this as a research topic and thinking about how it plays out in their lives, but it's just still also new. Yeah. So I thought it might be kind of fun to start out with, just to have our listeners spend a couple seconds just thinking about how much time you spend on screens. And I'm not counting work or listening to music, but just, you know, on devices and screens and technology, and just sort of estimate how much time per day you think you might spend, just to kind of give a sense of what a big piece of your life it might be. And also to just suggest that there's a possibility that you're actually underestimating your daily usage. There's been some studies that have suggested that people tend to guess about 50% too low in their estimate of how much they use. So whatever number you came up with that you think you're using per day, you might actually be using it even more. And the average person, it looks like, might be using it up to about 3 hours a day. some sort of device or screen, and picking up their phones like many, many times throughout the day.
Mm-hmm. It becomes sort of an automatic habitual response. And I imagine that if you just think about it right now, you know where your phone is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like and a, you an may extra not appendage. Right.
You don't know where your keys are or your purse is or a whole lot of other things, but you do know where your phone is. And it's like a sort of a second brain for many of us. And it seems that you and I read this book, Irresistible by Adam Adler, which was talking a lot about behavioral addictions and specifically behavioral addictions around technology. And he talks about how this use of phones is on the rise. So in 2008, we spent 18 minutes a day on our phones. Well, gosh, they'd only been around, cell phones, those smartphones had been around for a year. So we were just figuring out how to use them probably at that point in time. And now it's up to it was up to 3 hours by 2015. So as this rapid overuse or use is happening, we're starting to see sort of one of the first problems, which is this habitual nature to phone use and even the concept of behavioral addiction, of maybe even being addicted to our phone, like we can't leave it.
Yeah, and I think phones are especially tricky and problematic because we have them with us all the time. Like you said, you probably know where yours is right now. And unlike, you know, a desktop computer, which stays in one place, or even a laptop, you know, they have their phones in the car, in their beds. You know, I see people at my work sometimes walking up and down the stairs while looking at their phone. It's like, that's part of the problem, is that it's just in your hand so much. So yeah, well, why don't we dive in and start talking about what some of the latest psychology research has to say about this technology use so far. So one of the first issues that we want to talk today is this issue that Diana just mentioned about behavioral addiction. And it's interesting because I think the use of the word addiction is used pretty loosely in this context, because people use it a lot of times to be like, oh, I was so addicted to this one app or this one, you know, TV show I was binge watching, or I was, you know, addicted to one video game or something like that. That's probably not what a psychologist would really mean by the technical definition of addiction, but what we can really see is a pretty big range in how problematic technology can be for people. Everything from just spending a little bit too much time on screens at the expense of other things we want to be doing. You know, we feel this pressure to be, you know, working all the time, checking our work email or keeping up with social media, or just, you know, when you get bored if you're waiting in line or something like that. Or just the sort of constant and automatic nature of it, which I think a lot of us can probably relate to that to some degree, a lot of us smartphone users. So that's probably on the less extreme end, but still a little bit problematic. But it really can be more serious for some people. And some people do seem to have a pretty serious behavioral addiction to, you know, video games and to social media. And it can be really problematic for people if they basically stop the ability to freely choose whether or not they're going to keep doing the behavior, or if they start to experience adverse effects in their life. Like, you know, for instance, a student who fails out of college because they can't stop playing a video game and they just spend days and days playing it and they never leave their, you know, their dorm room. That's a pretty serious problem. And more, I think that, you know, there's treatment centers and people are sort of acknowledging that this is a real problem for people.
And Adam Adler talks about how these games are actually designed to be particularly addictive. So behavioral addiction is actually a newer concept in psychology in terms of it was just introduced into the DSM-5. So the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual describes the different psychological disorders. And it's only recently that it included behavioral addictions as an Axis 1 disorder. So the nature of behavioral addictions is that they actually activate the same brain areas that you see with substances of addiction. So, for example, that dopamine system, the reward system, and dopamine being a neurotransmitter that is specifically associated with wanting or craving, not necessarily liking. That's actually a different system. So when you are engaging in an addictive substance and you have that sense of, I want it again, like you have that craving for a donut as you drive or smell the donuts, That is your dopamine system giving you that wanting. Mm-hmm. And you can, that's why with some of our addictions, we can continue to want them even though we don't like them anymore. Continue to use a substance even though you don't like it. Mm-hmm. So for something to be addictive, we need to activate that dopamine system. And certainly the rewarding nature of cell phones, getting some reinforcement from the cell phone, bings and pings and likes and all of that are rewarding, or gaming is very rewarding, in combination with addressing a psychological pain or discomfort. So that pairing of the two. So for example, if you're thinking about you're waiting in line and you're bored, you have that psychological pain or discomfort, and then you can turn to using your phone to escape from that. And then your phone gives you a little bit of a dopamine hit. It's a little bit rewarding to look at your Facebook or see if someone saw your photo. So that would be sort of mildly reinforcing and why you'd go back to doing that again and again. But there's certain times or populations that are actually more susceptible to our phones or gaming to be particularly addictive. So if you think about a young adult who's feeling left out and lonely, then you may go online and be able to friend a friend in Dubai and play a video game with that person. So you get to have that dopamine system being activated from the video game in combination with that psychological need being met. And that's sort of the deadly combo for things being particularly addictive.
Mm-hmm. It just keeps the behavior going because, yeah, it's so reinforcing that pattern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And what I was really interested in is learning more about how are the architecture of video games and also social media are actually, they're designed to be particularly ripe for abuse, particularly addictive. And there was four main qualities that are associated with that. So the first is, do you remember intermittent reinforcement from?
Oh, yeah. Like, from good old Skinner, right.
Good old
from
Skinner,
right. Behavioral psychology days, yeah.
Yes. And actually we use it a lot. I mean, I use it a lot talking about a lot of different things in my practice, yeah. This concept of intermittent reinforcement. I actually talk about it with parents and tantrums quite a bit.
And I think a good shortcut for intermittent reinforcement, so you can remember it, is to think of slot machines at casinos. Yeah. That kind of, you know, sometimes you get a reward, sometimes you don't. And so you can go a little while, but you still keep wanting more reward. And every once in a while you get one. So it just keeps the behavior going because you never know when you're going to get that reward.
Right. So behaviors that are reinforced in an intermittent way like that are particularly strong and difficult to change or to put on what's called extinction, which is making that behavior stop. And that's why slot machines are so successful and actually one of the biggest money makers in Vegas because of intermittent reinforcement. But there's also intermittent reinforcement built into things like Facebook. So if you look at Facebook and the Facebook interface, it's filled with a few different numbers and stats that you look at every time on Facebook. You look at the number of people who like this, the number of shares, and the number of comments. And so every time one of those numbers goes up, you're getting a little reinforcement and a little intermittent reinforcement because it doesn't go up every time you look on Facebook or every time you post something, right? And it's a little bit random. Same thing with Instagram or other things of people liking it. So social media is designed to be a beautiful intermittent reinforcer, which means you're going to keep on going back to get to see if you got that point. And likewise, video games are designed to be intermittently reinforced. So they design video games so that you get a win pretty early on, so you get a sense of success. And then they move out the rewards in the video games sort of at further and further distances in terms of your quests or the efforts as you go along, so that it takes longer to get reinforcement, but it's also somewhat random that you get that reinforcement. It's not always a guarantee, and that's what keeps you playing. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect, yeah, that makes them addictive. Another addictive quality is that the juice that they put in games. So do you remember, did you ever play Candy Crush?
I didn't. I've heard a lot about it and I've seen it, but I never got into it. Luckily, I avoided that one. Did you?
Yeah. I played it a little bit, and I saw it a lot among like my mom's friends playing Candy Crush, and it's this game. It's a lot like Tetris, And it's filled with juice. So by juice, meaning there's lots of like bright lights and pretty colors and sounds that go off. And actually that makes us want to engage with something more. Rats will press a lever for like sugar water and cocaine a lot more quickly if you give them pings and sounds and bright lights while they're pressing a lever. And humans are not far off from this. So we love the juice that they put into games. And likewise, Candy Crush is this other component, and video games has this other component of our brains love to meet, to have goals and to achieve things like we really want to achieve. And so with Candy Crush, all these, if you line up all of the candies, you get this little bing and they disappear. And so you have this reward of getting your goal met, and then it instantly disappears, and then you have to work at the next goal. And meanwhile, the board is getting filled up with candy. So it's this never-ending mess that you have to clean, but then you're getting rewarded for these small little tasks in the corner, and that makes it particularly addictive.
Oh man, I can never play that. I will lose hours. Yeah. It sounds really, yeah. Easy
so
to
the
get
combination
on that one.
Yeah, of juice and then also this goal setting that we, you know, we think about also with the goal setting with other technologies in terms of, you know, people wanting to get 10,000 steps, and that even got addictive for folks, right? They wanted to, my husband used to walk around our living room to get his 10,000 steps by the end of the day.
Oh, did you see the David Sedaris article about this? We can link to it. Did you see that? Yeah.
Yes.
He just kept getting more and more steps till he was just walking all day just to get steps. Pretty funny. Humorous take on it. Yeah.
Well, just wanted, our brains just are, and that's totally evolutionary, right? Yeah. It's a good thing to set goals and get them if it means it's going to make a fire and food for the night, but not so meaningful if you're just like deleting bright colored candies on a screen.
Right. For hours.
So then, and then finally, our phones and games can be particularly addictive because they create these social connections or this feeling of social connection, which is so reinforcing and rewarding. It's one of our core basic needs as humans. And they can also relieve psychological stressors through distraction and avoidance. So all of that put together makes them really ripe for overuse.
Absolutely. And a second issue that more and more research is suggesting is that the use of screens and smartphones is really impacting our sleep. And it seems to be the phones more than anything else, you know, obviously, since it's easy to lug them to bed, that are most problematic, and they're very, you know, easy to do all hours of the night. And just a couple things that is out there. So it seems like the phones sort of keep us awake even when we're tired. So at night, normally, you know, our bodies kind of unwind. Our pineal gland produces melatonin, which makes you get tired. But when you're staring at the light from a smartphone, that kind of blue light from the screen, it, you know, goes into your, through your eyes, through the retina, and basically makes your brain think it's time to be awake. So it sort of throws off your circadian rhythm in that way. Also, you know, there's just so much information that we can be looking at right before bed. And a lot of people sleep with their phones right by their beds and don't turn them off, use them for an alarm clock and whatnot. And it just gets us going. It's sort of stimulating. And I know for myself, just kind of a quick personal example, that there's been so much going on in the news lately. For a while, I had a habit that was not very helpful to me, which is that I'd stay up too late just reading the news on my phone. First of all, I was staying up later than I should have been just doing that. And it was sort of stimulating. So it was keeping me awake past the point where I was tired. But then also I'd finally get to the point where I'd be like, okay, enough. And I'd turn it off. And then my mind was just sort of buzzing with all the news and, you know, just thinking and worrying and stuff like that. So I noticed for myself, I was going to sleep much later than I really wanted to using my phone. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. And there have been some studies. There was a study at the University of Rhode Island where they asked college students to keep track of their iPhone use and sleep or smartphone use. And about 40% said they woke up at night to answer phone calls. And 47% said they woke up at night to answer text messages. And of course, those people had poor sleep quality, which was also predicted, sort of linked to depression and anxiety, which makes a lot of sense. You know, that really does take a toll on your mood.
And this unlimited sort of leaving your phone on overnight, I see it a lot with some of my college students. And when they talk, I often ask about their phone use and ask about their sleep. And when they talk about their phone use at night, they say they leave on their phone, one, because they don't want to miss out on what's happening at night, or they wake up in the morning and it's the first thing they do is look at their phone to see what happened. So it's that this whole life is happening overnight while they're trying to sleep. And your brain is monitoring that. I mean, our brain is really good at having sort of a running, its own running app, right?
Right.
And if you have an app that is running, that's trying to figure out if my phone is collecting, you know, information, it's going to be hard to turn off your brain to go to sleep. And that's such an important time for your brain to do its cleaning and, you know, integrating information and just restoring itself so that it's ready for the next day, removing toxins. So that's a real concern. And the fear of missing out, I think, is sort of the theme here that is part of whether it's missing out on news or it's the rapid pace of things, that there's always more and more and more that you could be getting information from your phone or reading about. And at some point, we have to be able to put it down and turn it off. And that's more sort of our job to figure out what we're talking about today. So that leads to the anxiety and stress.
Yeah.
Right?
Another problem of related to this technology use is how it impacts stress and anxiety.
All of the beeps and alerts that are going on, bings and pings. So I was just putting my kids to bed before we were talking, Debbie, and my phone went bloop, 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 bloop. That's not a sound I'd usually hear from my phone, but it's the Skype sound. I think you were lying.
Oh, sorry.
And so here's what happens, right? I'm putting my kids to bed and I hear bloop, 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 bloop. And so I start thinking, oh, I better hurry this up.
Yeah.
Aww. How sad. I just have a sad face. How sad. I'm singing my song that we sing a couple of songs at night, and now I'm singing my song really quickly. Because I have to go, because my phone just interrupted a really precious time. And even though I knew we had our time set and it would have been fine if I went 2 or 3 minutes over. So that's the fear of missing out. And what was I really missing out on in that moment? Singing to my kids.
Right. Yeah.
Right. That's what I'm missing out on. I'm not missing out on being on time for Debbie.
Right. This lovely, like, in, you know, connected moment with people who are right there in front of you.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't have that much longer that I'll be able to sing to my young boys. Right. It's a short period of time. You get to sing a song and they actually think that it's not ridiculous. Right.
Right.
So the fear of missing out, there's a research at Cal State University where they took away smartphones from college students for an hour, and they had them in three different groups. So one group was light users, and for light users, there was no change in anxiety when they took away their phones. But for moderate users, they started to experience anxiety after about 25 minutes, and it remained at a moderate level for the rest of the time. Heavy users, they saw an increase in anxiety after only 10 minutes of their phone being away, and it continued to increase throughout the hour. So the take home message being really the more that you use, the more fear that you have of being away. And it's sort of this insidious loop, right? So you're fearful of being away from your phone, so therefore you use it more, you keep it on you more. And we see this not only with phone use, but also with people being really locked into emails. So there was, when I was in graduate school, emails were like you had to respond within the hour. Was it like that for you in graduate school with emails?
More so toward the end, yeah. Became where people would expect a reply right away. And it didn't matter if they sent the email, you know, late in the day or early in the morning or something like that. It was, yeah. There's a little pressure.
I think it depends on what setting you're in around email use. Now, if you give me an email, you're lucky if you get a reply. I'm so slow on.
Yeah, but you're probably an outlier in that. I mean, although no, with text messaging, maybe not so much. But yeah, but I think people are expected to be on a lot.
Right. They're expected to be on and expected to be responsive. And there was a study that showed that 70% of office emails are read within 6 seconds. So this sets up this expectation to be at your desk. And as a result, you're sitting there, Phil, it's basically another version of Candy Crush, right? As soon as the emails are coming in and you're dealing with the next email, meanwhile, you're not dealing with the rest of the pile of stuff that really needs to be dealt with. And you're locked onto your desk. You don't have great attention. And it really prevents office workers from doing things like going outside or being able to stay on task. And you have a high alert. So they found some research that showed decreased heart rate variability when people are so checking their emails all the time and so alert, which is decreased heart rate variability is associated with basically stress. Mm-hmm. So when we actually look at what happens when we limit people from checking their email or ask them to keep their phones away. So if there was APA Monitor is American Psychological Association puts out sort of a magazine that gives sort of current research topics. And they recently had a whole article that I really, really liked on technology use.
Well,
and
we can link to that on our webpage.
We'll link to it.
So people can find it. It's a good article. Yeah.
It's a good article. And actually, I started applying in my practice with people. One was some research by Costanzin Cushlin, who said that when people did a study where she found that people who limit email to checking to just 3 times per day, they saw decreases in daily stress, increases in mindfulness, and increases in self-perceived productivity and quality of sleep. So actually containing the madness, like having a limit on this is when I check email. And I certainly do that to the best of my ability, where I really don't check email all that frequently. I mean, unless I know an email's coming in, I'll check it maybe, I don't know, maybe 3 times a day. I don't know. How often do you check your email? How much are you checking with it?
It depends what I'm doing. I would say the days that I'm at work, I do tend to just keep it open all the time during the times that, you know, not when I'm meeting with a client, but when I'm just sitting at my desk typing on the computer or something like that, I keep it open a lot. And then I might check my email as I'm on the go. So I'd say mm-hmm. I definitely maybe need to consider working on this and keeping it limited more. We'll talk when we get to the end of this episode. We're going to talk a little bit about some strategies that people mm-hmm. might want to, you know, who might be experiencing this or who want to work on changing this behavior in this direction might find helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so one area that people are starting to be interested in and take a look at, it's still a really new area of research, but is how all of this technology use is affecting our cognition. Like, how is it affecting our cognitive abilities? And a question that I've seen out there that was also mentioned in that Adam Atler book that we've been mentioning is the question of whether our attention spans are getting shorter, you know, because of the fact that we scroll so quickly through so much information and there's just a ton of information available to us all the time that it's just this barrage. And some people have wondered if perhaps that's making it harder to focus and to just really mm-hmm. pay sustained attention to things. And there's one study that was reported in that book that we've been talking about, the Adam Atler book, that Microsoft Canada measured how long people were focusing on certain information. And in the year 2000, they were paying attention to things for 12 seconds. And by 2013, it had reduced down to 8 seconds. So a little difference there, which is suggestive. I mean, I think this is all very new, but this suggestion that maybe it is affecting how we attend to things. And I know for myself that what I've noticed is that I have a little bit of a harder time like reading a whole article from start to finish, that when mm-hmm. sometimes when I'm reading the news or, you know, sort of an online something I come across online and I'm like, oh, that looks interesting. And I start to read it a couple paragraphs in, I'm like ready to move on to the next thing. And sometimes I have to remind myself, okay, wait, hold on, slow down. Keep reading this because there's something interesting here. But I think there's just this, we're just so used to just fast paced information all the time. Mm-hmm. We get used to that.
Right. I think we get used to fast paced information and we get used to all of us being a little bit distracted. So because people are picking up phones or things are being, even in my sessions, I'll see clients with the phone on the table. And if it bings or it makes something visually comes up on it, they will look to it and put their mm-hmm. hand on it. And it's a distractor. Even if we're in a completely engaged, meaningful conversation, it pulls us away. So we're just used to getting pulled away and we're so automatically habituated to look, right?
Yeah,
or to pick up. And what I think is interesting is also thinking about how this is impacting our children's attention span. And so we know that infants, the first thing that they're tracking early on is their own parents' eyes. So they're watching us, they're watching our behaviors, watching our eyes instinctively to know what to pay attention to. And if our children are watching our eyes and watching us look at our phones and then look at them and then look at our phones, or maybe just even looking at our phones while we're doing something else, we're teaching them basically to be distracted and not to pay attention to the task at hand. And what we see is that decreases in attention span in children is a problem. Children's attention is associated with language development and problem solving and cognitive development, all these really important tasks. We also see decreases in, potentially decreases our children's attention span with the fast speed of things. Sometimes I'll have clients that come in late, and I love this saying from Kelly Wilson, which is, there just is not enough time, so we really need to slow down.
Yeah.
So let's talk about driving, because I love that you brought this up in terms of our attention and how phones are impacting that.
Well, I think this is a really important issue because it's a potentially, life-threatening issue, which is that people are in car accidents associated with distracted driving all the time. There is a statistic that in 2014, about 3,000 people died in accidents that were associated with distracted driving. And because we have our phones with us all the time and we have them in the car for legit reasons like our, GPS, and we might be listening to music or a podcast. So I bet some people listening to this podcast are driving around, and that's fine. But what happens is that it's right there. We end up, grabbing our phone while driving, or we can't resist responding to this alert that we get. And so, if you look around on the highway, you'll see people kind of waving around, and a lot of people you'll see are looking down, kind of fiddling with their phones. And I mean, we know that just even talking on the phone while driving is dangerous. There's a book called The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us, by some cognitive psychologists, Chris Chabris and Dan Simons. And they write about how, our attention is a limited resource. We only can pay attention to so much information at one time. And we really can't pay adequate attention to the road if we're chatting on our phones while driving. And it's not an issue of hands free or not. It's an issue of limited attention. And same thing, maybe even worse, with texting while driving, or, just scrolling around on whatever people are doing while they're driving. And yet it's so difficult because the phone's right there and it's so compelling. But it's one of those things that it's so hard to resist the urge to just grab the phone, and yet we get away with it most of the time. So I think we think that it's an okay thing to do, but it really just takes one time when you get in a car accident for it to be a huge problem.
I really notice it when I want to change music, and all of a sudden I find myself, I picked up my phone to change the music, and I'm like scrolling through my music library. I'm looking for, certain artists and having to look in alphabetical. I mean, how distracted can that be? Right. I'm like trying to alphabetize somebody while I'm driving.
Yeah.
And it's super dangerous. And after our conversations around this, I am so proud of myself, Debbie. I made a commitment, and I made the commitment in front of my children. I put my phone in my purse, and then I move my purse out of the way so that I cannot reach it, so that even if a text were to come up, I can't look. And I've noticed myself, even in doing that, urges to use my phone while driving. It's shocking. I could call this plumber right now and organize, get that thing done that I need to get done. And it's actually been really nice to just know it's not a possibility. And I'm also doing another important thing, which is I'm modeling to my children not to be using the phone when driving, because I guarantee you, when our children grow up and they are, 16 and driving and they're terrible drivers, they will model the behavior that you engaged in while driving. So.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about some strategies. I think that's a great one, just keeping it out of reach, because, it is a hard behavior to resist, but it is such an important one. And it's, it's, I think, a really important thing for people to think about and put some effort into that.
And it's fascinating when you put limits on things, when you actually start to notice urges, which points a little bit to that dopamine
Yeah, absolutely. It's the internet, you know, it's just hard to, it's like hard to walk away from a slot machine. It's hard to not grab your phone. So another area I think that we wanted to talk about in terms of problems is how technology affects relationships. And I think we see this in so many different domains, you know, whether you're out to dinner with a friend or a romantic partner and you're distracted or just, you know, disengaging. One area I like to call it parenting while distracted. One area that is certainly a concern is, you know, it's really easy when you're a parent to spend a lot of time distracted because of technology. And I think one thing that people have wondered is how is this going to affect child development? And the bottom line is we don't know the long-term effects. I mean, I think a lot of people are concerned about that. This whole generation of kids whose parents are always checking screens. I mean, partly because it's just so new, the technology is so new. Also because there's just so many factors in development that it's just really hard to isolate something like that. And it's very difficult to set up a controlled study of something like that. Because it's such a pervasive behavior. But I can tell you, you know, children are just exposed to a lot of screens and media. They're in schools now. That's just the norm to have computers and devices around school and involved with homework, and parents are distracted. And I think that people are worried about what that will mean with just interpersonal attachment and the ability to have social skills, like the ability to read social cues in person, the ability to resolve problems face to face instead of over text message. And so I think in general, we just, you know, people are concerned about what that will mean. And it's just food for thought. Yeah.
So children, they learn empathy by watching how their actions impact others. So if you call someone a bad name in class and you see them start crying in front of you, and then the teacher sees them start crying, you have just had a learning experiment. Oh, when I say this word to somebody, it makes them feel that way and I get in trouble. And there's, you know, if you call someone a bad name over text, or say something mean about someone over social media, you don't get that same feedback. And this is really important when we think about our adolescents are communicating more and more via text and social media than they are in person. They're not getting that feedback of that hurt. And it's actually the emotional feedback, which is important for being able to develop sensitive, empathic relationships. And Atler reports on an analysis of 72 studies that showed that empathy has decreased between the year of 1979 and 2000 in college students. This may be one of the aspects of it. There's some information around narcissism being on the rise. So there may be a number of factors, but this is an important thing for us to be able to do, be able to take the perspective of others and be able to read the emotional cues of others. So an emoji is not the same as a facial expression. And if we think about, yes, in terms of children's relating to one another, but let's also even look at our own romantic relationships. How are we communicating with our partners or our, you know, our spouses? So there's these steps that we are taking that part of our human relating to one another is seeing the facial expression. There's so much tonal information in our voice. So what you read in a text has lost so much important richness to human connection because it's just words and there's no eye contact. So that's what I worry about, even just in our relating to our partners and our spouses, our children, our friends.
Yeah. I mean, this is just a thought that's just randomly occurring to me as you're talking about this, but I think that there's a reason why those little pictures and emojis are so frequently used, which is that there is still that desire to convey that in person something, you know, the emotion or the facial expression, but it's so different when it's so a little, you know, yellow face on a screen versus an actual human being in front of you. Yeah.
And so many times I'm sitting there scrolling through the emojis and I can't quite find the right one.
Right. Well, it's not quite right.
I should just say what I'm feeling.
Right. Yeah, there you go.
Probably trying to find the right one.
So another social kind of relationship issue that might be problematic is social comparison. You know, just this idea that we see what other people post online and people tend to only post themselves in these kind of happy, perfect moments of their lives, you know, going on this fabulous trip or eating this delicious meal or feeling really happy. And that sometimes we can get into a little bit of social comparison with that and some perfectionism for ourselves of feeling sort of not good enough or like, oh, I should be more like that. There's a book, a recent book called The Happiness Effect, How Social Media is Driving a Generation to Appear Perfect at Any Cost by Donna Friedis. I hope I said that right. And she talks about a study with 200 college students where only 19% said that they were open about their true emotions. And 73% said that they pretty much always appear happy on social media. So it just gives you a sense of what people are projecting into the world. And I mean, I think that there's a lot of pressure to do that. And you know, maybe social media isn't the best place to be super vulnerable because it's a it's out there and it's very public. It's permanently there. But it's really important, I think, to keep that in mind when people start to get into that social comparison and feel bad about themselves because, well, I didn't get to go on this fabulous vacation or, you know, wear this beautiful new outfit or go have this exciting time, is that they're not telling you the whole story. And, you know, that if you actually called them up or saw them in person, you might get to know more about what's really going on.
Right. And it's actually the what's really going on, which allows us to connect with one another.
Right.
Think about my clients that I just really appreciate. And part of why I really appreciate about them is that they share with me the vulnerable stuff, like what they're not, trust me, they're not posting what they tell me on social media.
And there's some research about that we tend to feel more connected and we tend to like and love people more when they're more full people who have those vulnerabilities and who have struggle. You know, when people have that sort of perfect facade, they're less likable to us because they don't seem as human. So, yeah,
right.
It's food for thought.
So the last issue that comes up around technology use is around physical health. And it really, the increase in technology has taken a toll on our body. So we can all do a practice right now. Pick up your phone. You know where it is.
You're probably hearing our voices through it. Let's be honest.
And most of the time,
but not if you're driving. Not if you're driving.
Most of the time, what we do is we look down at our phone, and what that does is it puts a lot of pressure on our neck, and we get the forward neck slump and the phone head. So, one thing you can do is hold your phone up to your face, and you will see more and more people doing this, and pull your chin back. We all need to be doing that. The other thing is how our technology keeps us really still. And if you come into my house.
I did.
We have no furniture in front of any screen in our home. We want to pay attention to our physical health and how maybe even some of the apps that are designed to make us healthier, they become more about that goal-directed activity of trying to meet the goal of the app rather than paying attention to our internal cues around movement and exercise. So if you're still walking around your living room at 9:30 at night to get your steps in, it's actually probably not that great for your sleep and probably not that, even beneficial for your body to be walking in circles at nighttime. So we can actually use these bodies and the information in our bodies to guide our movement or to guide our eating, as we talked about in the appetite awareness episode, as opposed to some external machine that tells us when to breathe. I don't need my watch to tell me to take a breath, okay?
I hope not, yeah. Well, so the next question, of course, is what do we do about all this? So we're going to kind of move in now to talking a little bit about a few ideas that we had based on our psychology training for how you might, manage technology in your life in a more effective way. And the first idea that we had is related to habits and just kind of behaviors. And one thing that can be really helpful is when you're talking about we're talking about behavior change here, is to set up your environment to make the behavior less automatic so that it's easier to change it. So one thing that I found really helpful that I'd really recommend people do is to change the alerts that you get on your smartphone. So I used to get alerts from social media, from a few news sources. And so a lot of times I'd just be grabbing my phone maybe because I'm about to walk out the door or I'm moving it or plugging it in or something like that. And or if I needed to make a call or something. And as I pick it up, I see all these alerts. So Facebook alerts and whatnot, and I would check them respond to them. And the next thing I know, all this time was lost because I had, mm-hmm. without even thinking about it, it was just so automatic, I would be sucked into social media. So now I changed my phone. The only thing I get alerted to are phone calls and text messages now. Mm-hmm. So I can still go on Facebook, and I do, but I have to open the app before I know what's going on. So mm-hmm. what it does for me is that it makes it more my choice. Like, I check it when I want to spend a few minutes on social media. Mm-hmm. but I don't just get sucked in because of an alert popping up.
Right.
Another.
Yeah. So putting some barriers in. Yeah. I think putting some barriers in. So anytime we have an automatic behavior, we want to try to figure out a way to slow it down.
Yeah.
And putting those barriers in and not, is super helpful. And likewise, I think even just the research on setting some times with which you engage in certain activities. So I will check my email when kids are in bed, or I'll check my email if I'm between a client or I have a break in a client, but I'm not going to be checking my email at the grocery store or checking my email, you know, so having some specific times when you engage in certain behaviors rather than it just being a constant ongoing thing.
Yeah. I'm going to work on that with email. I think that's helpful. To just put it in a more discreet mm-hmm. period of time. Okay, another suggestion is get yourself an alarm clock if you don't have one and keep your smartphone out of your bed. Just what I do, I've started doing this and I found it so helpful. I charge my phone in the kitchen, which is downstairs from my bedroom, every night. There's a, mm-hmm. every once in a while I violate this and I almost always regret it because then it's right there mm-hmm. and it's too easy to just pick it up first thing in the morning or stay on it too late at night. So I really mm-hmm. recommend, you know, don't use your smartphone for your alarm clock. Instead, before you're going to bed, stop your screen time, plug it in somewhere else, and just leave it out. That I think that really makes it so that you're not just checking it too late or first thing in the morning.
Mm-hmm. I really like not checking my phone first thing in the morning. That has been a big just really important practice, that when I wake up, the first thing that is going into my brain is not newsfeed.
Yeah. Right.
My brain, you know, and so when I wake up, I do my, you know, I do my morning practice, and it's not until I'm done with my morning practice of, you know, meditating and writing and having that time that is really doing what's most important to me before going into that world and getting my time, because it can just, yeah, it could steal it from you. Your morning.
Yeah. So, and whatever news is available to you will still be there 30 minutes later. So, you know, it'll still be there.
Right.
Another, we actually really talked about this already, but this habit of looking at the phone while driving or texting while driving or what have you, you know, just set up the environment to avoid that temptation. So I think what you were saying, that you keep it in your purse out of reach, that's really handy. If you don't need it for GPS or something like that, you can put it, either turn it off or put it on airplane mode while you're driving, just to reduce the temptation to grab it or to respond to an alert. Or just limit yourself, just pay attention to that urge and don't do it. Just make a point of that.
So it's also important to be active and not passive in social media use. There's some research that shows that when people use Facebook in a passive way, they feel worse about themselves. But when they engage in conversation and comment on others, they actually don't see the same kind of harm. So that's the going in and actually being an active user rather than just kind of floating around in there endlessly. It's taking back control over your technology use mm-hmm. and being intentional in how you're using and why you're using. There's this other concept of our goals, and trying to, rather than having our technology use be so sort of driven by all this goal-directed behavior of number of likes or Instagram looks, or that have set into place more of sort of a systems approach. So what are you doing on a daily basis that increases your odds of happiness in the long run? And really asking yourself, is this fear of missing out on something, me getting in here to be on the Skype call with you, actually interfering with something that is part of my core happiness and my core values? And we have limited time in our day. Plan accordingly mm-hmm. in how you're going to use your time and what's important to you. And if there are people that you want to stay connected to through social media, using that time to stay connected to them, but not using time, you know, in other areas that are just maybe depleting.
Yeah, and maybe sometimes we have the fear of missing out on the wrong thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think another one is managing others' expectations. So people will expect you to get back to them at a certain frequency if that's the frequency with which you get back to them. This is something I've very much learned as a therapist, haven't you?
Oh,
Like
yeah.
around returning phone calls and returning texts, that if you are quick to respond, people will expect you to be quick to respond. And you can set it up so that you tell people, I don't get back. I tell my clients, I don't get back to them, off until the end of the day. Emails, I often will not get back to within the same day. Phone calls, sometimes it's 24 hours. And part of that is because when I'm with you in session, I'm 100% with you. So that means I'm 100% with my clients in their sessions, and I'm not, I'm taking the time between sessions to either stretch or move or take a breath and meditate myself so that I can be prepared for the next client, so that I can be fully present. And so you get a more present me. And that often they say, okay, well, I'm willing to, wait the 24 hours. And we can do that, for other people in our lives too, family members,
Definitely.
friends.
Yeah, and people will just get used to that.
Yeah.
Another area we wanted to talk about is parenting with media awareness. We talked about this, parenting while distracted thing. I think it's really important to be a good role model of moderation and limited screen times to your kids, just what you're teaching them as they're watching you. So what I recommend people do is just think about your own values about screen time for your kids and just do your best to stick to that. It's not like it's horrible to have any screen time whatsoever, but you need to kind of decide for yourself what you think is reasonable and fits with your values as a parent, and then make that happen. And I know for my family, one of our values, we don't like to have the TV on just on all the time. I just don't like it to be in the main living space and just to be sort of background noise. That's to me personally, I find that, drives me bananas, but I also don't want my kids to have that always, in the background. But we do love movie night. We all enjoy it. We pop popcorn, we go down to the basement, which is where we keep our TV, and we make a big evening out of it. It's really fun. And so to me, that's just kind of how we set it up. And it's a slippery slope. I can't say that I don't occasionally, turn it on when I maybe perhaps shouldn't, according to my values, but I try to do my best to keep it in check.
We are so media limited here. My kids have not been exposed to very much at all. And, I'm definitely an outlier. I'm not on Facebook, and I just have very limited social media as well as technology in our home. And it is about figuring out what's important to you and using that as your guide, as opposed to maybe what other people are doing, as opposed to fearing missing out, and modeling that
Yeah,
for your kids, that you can do that, what's important to you, and be flexible as
yeah, and
well.
every family's different, so you have to figure out what works for you.
Another practice was, which is engage in looking at each other in the eyes. And it's sort of the lost art of having connection through eye contact. I know that in ACT therapy, that's actually eyes on is actually one of the exercises that we do, where we look at each other in the eyes and actually look for the sweetness behind the other person's eyes and also the suffering behind another person's eyes. And when we connect through eye contact, there's actually something that's really human, I think, transmitted. And I know that even through social, so as I'm looking at you, Debbie, we're like looking each other in the eyes right now.
On
I also
Skype,
know on Skype that even looking at a screen at someone, there's some research that shows that even if you're looking at them in the eyes on the screen, you're actually not really looking in their eyes. You're looking towards a camera or slightly off. And getting back into that practice of whether you're at the checkout, getting a coffee, taking that moment to look into somebody's eyes and say, I see you, and allow yourself to be seen, is a really important human experience. And to do the same with our children, teach them the art of eye contact, because it's one that is getting lost.
Agree. Yeah. Well, and finally, I think the last little nugget that we have here is just this idea of making a point of putting your devices down sometimes. Just put them down, maybe during a meal, dinner with your family or friends, or a social interaction. Make some time when you just aren't plugged in. Maybe some people do like an analog day, a digital free day every now and then, or even just a couple of hours when you leave it behind, or you just turn it off, put it away. And pay attention to how you feel when you are kind of hooked into overusing technology versus when you're unplugged and just notice the difference. Try that sort of, a friend of mine, her husband says, get in and then get out, this approach that mm-hmm. you sort of set aside some time. Maybe you want to have 20 minutes twice a day to check the news and social media. It's like, go in, do it, and then mm-hmm. get out, and then stay out for a while. So just yeah. maybe encouraging people to have those periods where you just aren't plugged in and just notice how that feels.
Okay. So I'm going to unplug for tonight. I'm going to turn my phone on an airplane and go get a good night's rest. How about you?
Yes, me too.
Yeah,
I think that sounds lovely. Good. Okay, well, thanks everyone for listening, and thank you, Diana.
Thank you, and we'll put our resources up on our webpage, and we'll be back for more of conversations between Debbie, Ray, and myself, and so keep listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes. You can also find us at www.offtheclockpsych.com. That's offtheclockpsych.com. Music by John Gu and Susie Stevens.